owner, homeowner's best friend.
Come on around back, Arizona. Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, the outdoor living hour of Rosie on the House. Your Saturday morning tradition since 1988. And if you're following along in our homeowner handbook, free publication that we send out to anybody that requests it. You know, today, it's the ultimate garden hour. We're talking soil building because we timed it perfect. I mean, we knew it was going to rain. We knew the soil was going to be soft for digging. We know this is the best time for, maybe not the best time. There's never a bad time for planting in Arizona, but you couldn't find a more enjoyable time to be outside in the garden, getting your hands in that black dirt soil.
Yeah, I mean, it is beautiful to be out in the doors and into the garden. I mean, this is the time. This is one of my favorite months of the year, I think, in Arizona. It's the month of March. And so welcome. You've made it. and all of your friends that live in other states, especially in the northern country and stuff, man, they want to be here. They want to be with you. And they may even want to be with you in the garden. So remember that. They might want to get out and do something because they've been holed up for months and want to get out and be a part of nature. And they want to get out in there. And you might be surprised how many might be willing to pull weeds for you just as a volunteer.
Why not?
Why not?
Can't hurt to ask. There's a lesson to be learned from Tom Sawyer.
That is correct. And if you got chickens, that's one of the easiest ways to get people to pick weeds for you, especially kids, because you just say, hey, you want to feed the chickens? And then you go outside and you start pulling weeds and feed the weeds to the chickens, and that's the entertainment right there. It's good stuff.
Useful chickens.
Yeah. And that is one of our soil-building friends that we have out there, and there's a lot of things that we'll dive into today. Because soil is so important when it comes to the health of your plant. I mean, when it all comes down to it, if you want a healthy plant, you need healthy soil. You know, healthy soil creates a healthy plant. Healthy plant means healthy people. And so if you yourself want to be more healthy, it starts with your soil. And more wars have been fought over healthy patches of soil than any other war. And now people think, oh, no, it's these political wars. It's like, not really. The underpinnings of where they go and what they attack and around the areas, it's all about resources. It's not about the political aligning. It's about control over food production and health. And that really what it comes down to. I mean, for all of us, our health is what determines our experience of life. And if our life then starts with the soil, we should pay more attention to it. And if you want to work less on the challenges that most gardens have, like weeds and pests, it starts with your soil. Because again, that healthy soil, if it's really working, it's alive and it's nutrient dense and the right moisture content and all those things, once it's set up, it kind of self-manages. And when it self-manages, the plants grow much healthier, much more vibrant, much more dense, which alleviates all the typical problems that you usually have to come back later and try to mitigate. A lot less weeds if you got healthy soil and you plant the stuff you want and all that stuff. So it's good stuff.
So weeds only grow, the weed seed is smart enough to know not to grow in good soil that you're cultivating for vegetable health production?
Well, I'm not going to judge the smartness of a weed seed. Weeds will grow wherever they feel best. Weeds typically will grow in even less healthy soil, so that's true. But a healthy soil is more conducive to growing the things you want, and that's the key. And you want to be able to cultivate a beautiful, healthy soil to grow the things you want fast, which then overtakes any type of weed that might be otherwise be a challenge. And so we can dive into some of that. I mean, how deep you want to go? I mean, there's layers of getting into soil, literally.
I want to go deep enough to get one of those carrots that's, you know, like 18 inches or 2 feet long, because I've never been able to get much past, you know, finger length.
A finger length. You got the fingerly.
And even in a raised container where I've got 3 feet of soil put in there, I can't get a carrot to grow past finger length. What's the secret? I want to go deep enough to get a good carrot.
So on that, you probably got a timing issue and you got a watering issue. So the water might be moving through a little too fast in that big, large raised bed, mm-hmm. and it's not able to really hold the moisture to justify the need for that carrot to drive any deeper. It's like, hey, I got plenty of surface water. He's watering me every day or whatever. And so it's just, it's silking through too fast. And so it can't get as deep. It has no need. But another side of it, most people have short carrots because they got short soil depth. Mm-hmm. And that's
what I always thought. But then when I had this big container garden and I'm still getting the same size carrot, I'm like, what? I must be getting bad carrot seeds.
Well, the other thing about carrots and a lot of the root crops, they like a density of soil that's actually a little higher than probably what you'd expect. They actually like a little bit of density so that they can root into it. You know, they like to dig. Now, they don't like to chisel, but they do like to dig. So if you got really hard soil, it ain't going through that. It's going to just stub out, and it'll actually put out little arms. I mean, if you've ever seen pictures online of people that have carrots that have like two legs, it looks like a little person sitting. And, you know, they're cute and all, or they're pudgy little things. That's because they hit a hard pan or they hit a rock or something, and they're trying to grow around that. And so that's one type of stubby carrot. But the second type, it's an under-nutrient, under-watered carrot. It just didn't get enough moisture. It's like if I grew a carrot in sand and I watered it on a regular schedule, it's infrequent, and then that water's just going to drain right through, and it just stays a little stubby because it didn't have enough time to pull up the nutrient in the water that it needed in order to grow and drive deeper. So my first guess, again, with anybody who's got a shortened carrot, you got to go deeper. And 18 inches is the minimum depth for what we like to see for a good nutrient-rich soil for the general vegetable crops that most people are growing. And that's an important piece of the puzzle. A lot of people, they're going to dig down 4 inches and find a hard pan, and they just kind of stop there and hope that the carrot will do its own job, but it won't. And so it's important first to get that at least 18 inches well-draining, but be able to hold moisture like a sponge. And as many of you probably know in your desert climate out here with your soil, as it dries out, it often cracks. And like the sponge on your countertop or, you know, in your kitchen, it kind of curls up when it dries out. That's the same thing soil does. But like a sponge, when you get it wet, at first when you try to put water on a dry sponge, what's the water do?
It kind of runs off.
It just bounces off. It needs to get in there slowly so it doesn't just run off. I mean, that's where flash floods often happen. The worst times for a flash flood is when we've had a large dry spell and then we get a pounding of rain, because the soil, even though it's thirsty, it's hydrophobic. It's repelling water. It's like a hydrostatic force that repels the water first, and it just runs. And so same is happening with your garden. If it's too dry, too bone dry, if your ground is too dry and you water it heavily, it's just going to move off. So you got to water it slow, and then as the water starts getting into that sponge, what starts happening to it? Starts kind of swelling up, and then it starts filling, and then all of a sudden it holds more water, and then when it's fully saturated, a sponge will actually drain straight through the sponge. It doesn't drain over the top, it drains through it. And that's exactly what we want our soil to do. We want it to really hold moisture just like a sponge does. So it starts off a little slow. Once it's swelled up, the water's going to drain through, not over the top and out. We don't want it to pool, essentially. We don't want to have puddles in our gardens, especially where we're growing our vegetables.
So how do I make my Arizona clay soil act like a sponge? Well, what do I need to put in it, till it, garden it, rake it, amenities? What's the first step?
Well, the first step is to break through that clay layer and really at least establish an 18-inch base of kind of churned-up soil. Now, there's different philosophies out there, and this is, if we got a clay, dry soil, it's dusty on the top, and we're trying to cultivate that, turn that into a garden, I'm going to till it. I'm going to dig that stuff up, and I'm going to churn it. I'm going to get some air into it, and then I'm going to add an ingredient that is almost vital to transforming a native hard pan or even a constructed soil. So a lot of you, and living in HOAs, if you got a new house, that's all been engineered. Your soil is not soil. It's compacted dirt. It's engineering grade concrete dirt, basically, is what it is. And it's all compacted. And it's at least 3 feet thick of just really hard, hard soil. You got to dig and loosen all that stuff back up and bring some nutrient back into it. Otherwise, it's not going to grow much of anything without a lot of effort. And so you till it, you get it down at least 18 inches of all tilled up, and then we'll add gypsum. So gypsum's a great ingredient that is very helpful at breaking up hard pan and breaking up the effect that clay typically has to our soil, which creates that slimy layer and water just draws off. You get a little bit of gypsum in there, about a half a cup per square foot in your initial installment of it. And that's the first ingredient you put down after you've churned it all up. Now, after that, you got to now start adding some biomass. And so good composted manures is a great layer to be putting in, something that's alive. is very important, because that's the other piece of the puzzle. If I can build a living system of soil, now that's something that can manage itself. I've got billions of little workers of all the microbes and of bacteria, the fungi, all those things working in my favor while I'm not there. And that helps build your soil on the long-term basis. And once you've done that initial tilling, that initial stuff in there, you don't really ever have to till again, provided that you're cycling your crops and cycling your plantings in a proper fashion. And that's another key. It's like no till is really where you want to get to, because the more you disturb a healthy soil, the less effective and vibrant it is. And so we want to like kind of not mess with it, because it starts creating this network, a really healthy soil. So just to describe it, if I'm wanting to do a little soil test for myself, I might go into my garden and I'm going to dig a 1 foot little pit. And I'm going to grab some of that soil that's kind of the core of that soil, and I'm going to make a ball out of it. And if I'm holding that ball in my hand, and then I open my fingers, a healthy soil is going to crumble apart just a little bit, but still be a little sticky. And it'll fall into little pieces, and I can kind of roll it in my hand, and it'll break into about pea-sized pieces, and it'll be kind of sticky to itself. It'll have a good a little bit of moisture to it, but it's not dripping wet. You know, so it's got some moisture. It's the little pearl size kind of pieces or pea size pieces, but it still kind of sticks together. That's a good healthy soil. Now, if I've got a clay soil and I make a ball out of it and I open my hand, it's going to even show the impressions of my fingers of where they were. And that's, you know, good indication. I got a lot of clay. I'm going to probably need a little more gypsum. Now, if it's too dry and there's no life in it and I open my hand, it's just going to all fall apart. It's still going to fall through my hands almost like sandwood. That's not healthy either. So we want somewhere between falling through my fingers and holding tight like a ball.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow.
Yes, and it is the ultimate garden hour. We've got Justin Ronner of Agriscaping in studio today. 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE-4U if you'd like to join the conversation or ask your question about any kind of gardening project or advice you would like for your home, castle, or cabin. And you can text questions to 411-923 or send an email to info@rosieonthehouse.com. If you need to snap a picture for a little plant or insect identification, you can send it that way. You said something that was very eloquently put, and I'm gonna steal it from you, and I'm putting it out there right now so it goes on record. But you said, the health is the experience of life is our health. Or something like that.
Yeah. It's like how we experience life is really based on our health. It's like if our health is frayed or challenged in any way, it changes the way we see all of our experience of life. That's what it does. You know, it's like if I'm not feeling well, it's like everything doesn't look well. But if I'm feeling good, then everything starts looking better. And so if that, our health, is our experience of life, and most of our health is based on what we eat or what we take in, it's like, oh, it's really coming from your soil. And soil is probably one of the most important commodities, I guess you could say, on the planet. And if it should be alive. Alive for you in your garden, alive for you in everything that you're eating from. And that's an important piece of the puzzle.
I like that. Very, very nice. So gypsum, big part of breaking up the clay. So what is it that gypsum physically does to the soil?
So gypsum's kind of a magical stuff. What it does is there's a static bond. So as things dry out, I mean, everybody understands that as your hair dries out, it kind of gets more staticky, things like that. Well, as soil dries out, there's a static kind of issue that happens there too. And there's a silica. The silica plates, this is why clay works the way it does, is these silica plates start lining up to each other, and then as it dries out, they compress and they make a tight bond. And that's what makes it impervious to water getting through it, is because they're making these little static bonds that makes the water go laterally around the silica plates. And then what gypsum does is it basically breaks that static bond. And so just chemically, as it's percolating, as you get water going through gypsum through clay, what it's basically doing is it's snapping that bond, that static bond, to allow water through. And it happens almost instantaneously. Anybody, you put a little bit of, if you got some really a clay ball like we were talking about earlier, we got this clay ball in our hand and we take some gypsum, we kind of coat it with a little bit of gypsum and then just move it a little bit, it just starts breaking up into little pieces quickly. And so that's the power of gypsum, is its ability to then break those bonds that make clay clay. And that's what makes it work.
And where do you get gypsum?
Gypsum, it's such an inexpensive additive that it's often hidden, as you often find in grocery stores and things like that. Things that people need that are the least expensive approach to it, it's going to be at the bottom shelf, over in a corner. It's not in the prime zone. And so you can find them at all your major garden centers will have gypsum. You just need to ask for it because it's not going to be readily available label-wise where it's at. You know, you can get a 40-pound bag for under $10 in most cases, and a little of that will go a long way. And you really only have to put it in once. You know, it's not something that you have to keep reapplying because it's mineral, and it's a mineral that has an effect on its surrounding area, and then it's not something that really decomposes or degrades over time. Also has a little bit of calcium in it, which is also very beneficial for those of you out there that want to grow tomatoes and don't want to get blossom end rot on your tomato. That calcium that's inherently inside of that becomes accessible over time for the plant, and so it reduces a lot of the effect of blossom end rot. Just by gypsum.
Now, I may be asking a question that's a little more technical, but I'm kind of stuck on this gypsum stuff.
You're loving the gypsum,
where,
huh?
Do you know where they mine it?
I don't, actually. It is a mined product. I mean, a good example of gypsum that's happening in your house is actually you got gypsum board all throughout your house, drywall. Drywall is made of gypsum.
Well, and that was kind of where I was going with that, because I know they've got a big factory out of Vegas. And I mean, they ship tons of drywall into Arizona out of the Vegas plant. And I mean, you can see it on 60. I mean, there'd just be truckloads coming in. If you're on 60 and you know, like Grand Avenue and Carefree Highway right around 6 o'clock in the morning, you could very easily see a dozen trucks just stacked, tons of gypsum board on it. Is that the same? I mean, is the truck behind it with the tarp over it? Is that all pallets of gypsum for gardening that they're shipping into? Is that the same?
It could be. I mean, gypsum for gardening usually a little bit, it's a rougher grade. You know, it's more an ag grade gypsum. It hasn't been refined or powdered as much and compressed. And so it's usually it's a little less expensive. But if you do have drywall that you're doing a drywall job, you know, it doesn't have a lot of paint on it and stuff, and you got some extra drywall, you can just crush that stuff up and you could use it. But the challenge is it's most effective when it's more of at a granular or powder kind of state. And so that's why getting it in its original form is a little bit easier to work with. You know, you don't have to keep watering this gypsum board and, you know, see it swell up and have it, you know, break apart for you before you can use it in the garden. So just to get a bag of gypsum, it's cheaper.
And so how much am I putting in, let's start in 10 by 10.
So you got a 10 by 10 space. It's about a cup. I mean, mostly what I do is I'm looking at a volume, like a cup per square foot is the max, usually about half a cup. Volume-wise that I'm sprinkling in 1 square foot is the max I'd ever really need. And I can just spread that over that entire area. And so, you know, if I've got a 50-pound bag, I can easily do 100 square feet off of a 50-pound bag. And that would be a pretty good amount of gypsum. You could see it on the ground, but that's even more than you would need. So you can easily go probably twice that with the same bag.
Is it something like fertilizer that if you're not paying attention, you could over-apply too much and then you have a negative effect the opposite way?
The negative effect would be pH, which is a great place to jump into when we get off the break.
Soil, soil everywhere. Growth food that we all share. It gets between your toes and in your hair.
While it's dirty fun to roll in the mud, there's a lesson to be learned here, 'cause soil is good for everyone. There are many kinds of soil on earth, and everyone has its worth. Rainforest,
deserts too,
soils that work for me and you. Let's learn how we can save our soil.
And that's the topic today, soil building in the Ultimate Garden Hour with Justin Rahner of Agriscaping. We had a question. I know we're going to get to the adverse side of too much pH if you overdo your gypsum. But text question comes in and says, before digging a hole for a tree to plant, would gypsum be a good additive?
So I definitely love putting gypsum at the bottom of the hole, especially it shows signs that it's not going to drain through well. Because on any tree, if we want that tree to grow big, we want it to be able to drain through well. And so anytime I dig a tree hole, we like to actually add some water at the very bottom of the hole and see if it percolates quickly through it. If it doesn't, then we're definitely going to be adding some gypsum into the base of that pit before we start planting that tree. And so it is a great additive. But that kind of leads into, well, what are the negative effects? And you said it almost perfectly, where you end up adding too much pH, and that's exactly what happens. The pH rises, and so we become more alkaline as you put more gypsum into the soil. And the ideal scenario, the ideal pH for our soil is going to be between 6 and 7, really a little bit on the acidic side, which is a lower pH. And what gypsum does is it actually raises the pH, makes it more alkaline, and it's not optimal. But what we do and why we put gypsum down first as well is that we want it to perk through the soil to affect the soil perk rate and also add a little bit of long-term calcium. But then from that point, now we start building the biomass. And a good, healthy soil, especially for growing vegetables, flowers, any of that stuff, we want about one-third biomass into that soil, one-third organic matter with a little bit on the acidic side. And the acidic side is really letting us know that it's got some life to it. It's got some movement chemically that's going on. And the acidity allows for more movement of nutrient into the plant. You know, without the acidity, it's really hard for most plants to uptake the nutrients they need. And so they suffer. A good example is actually blueberries. Not a lot of people know that we can grow blueberries in Arizona. We can, but the key ingredient is ensuring that our soil has a pH between 4.5 and 5.5. So it's actually way more acidic in order for it to uptake the nutrients it needs without getting salt burn. And so if you've got trees out there that have little tip burns on them and stuff like that, a lot of the reason for that is that, number one, it's either low drainage, so we might add some gypsum to create some better drainage. And number two is we've got some salt burn. And that salt burn is often effect because, again, low drainage or high pH. And so you can offset low drainage by lowering your pH and making it more acidic. So soil sulfurs is a lot of the reason or ways that people do that chemically. But the long-term best way to do it is life. You know, having more bacterial activity, having worms, you know, a type of soil that worms love to live in is slightly on the acidic side. And they actually improve that and they balance it. They create a buffer that kind of, they've got these slimes that go along the worms that actually creates a buffer that keeps the pH between 6 and 7, which is exactly what we're talking about. That's the ideal soil condition. So worms, the best soil builders on the planet, we can learn a lot from just how they exist and what the environment they create for themselves is perfect for plants. I see a question for
there's
me, so
like
I'm just
six,
waiting for
and I'm
it.
Trying to decide which one to start with. But on pH soil testing, how do you know you're between a 6 and an 8? Is there an easy like home tester kit you stick in the dirt and it like a pool testing kit that you?
Yeah, I mean you could use a pool testing kit, but what it takes is you have to make sure you got some moistness to your soil, and you're basically testing the water that's coming off of the soil after you put water on the soil. So if I get a little bit of soil, I get it wet. And then I can put the little litmus paper inside of that. And then I'd see the color and see what the color is and look at the little color chart and see where my pH is, relatively speaking. There's also probes that you can stick in the soil, have electrode probes that go in, and they can test pH that way as well. The trick is, though, is again, it needs to be a moist soil, not super wet, because then you're just testing the pH of the water. We want to test the pH of the soil. We need it moist enough that there's some transference for those electrodes to be activated. Yeah, I can't just stick it in dry soil and think I'm going to get an effective pH test. I got to get it wet. It's got to be moist. And that's how you can tell. I mean, that's usually how we do our tests. Another way is just growing plants. I mean, when you get around plants long enough, I can tell. You know, if I'm growing some radishes, I can see how the leaves are growing. I can basically tell you what's going on with the pH in your soil in at least that first surface level, as well as what's probably nutrient-wise available to the plant. You know, growing quick things, seeing how weeds are growing for people. It's like I can usually tell. It's like if I got a thinner leaf, that means I'm probably pretty high alkaline because there's not enough nutrient being drawn up. So if I've got a plant in one part of my garden that's got really thick, vibrant leaves, no bugs, and then another area that's got thinner leaf, same plant, and it's attracting a lot of bugs, what's often happening is I've got a high pH and I need to bring the pH down so it can uptake the nutrients that are available, especially if it's all the same soil. And so plants are good indicators. They were the first probes of helping us find out if we had good soil or bad soil. It's like, well, plants are growing over there, good soil. No plants growing over there, bad soil. But we can activate soil. We've gotten smart enough learning from nature, and that's the core of it too. Everything that we know about science to grow plants is learning from nature originally. And if you can go back to nature and let it do its job, so set up the right conditions, you're going to be a genius to all of your neighbors. And they're going to think you've studied all this other stuff, but really what you've done is you've helped nature do what it does best. That's what science is always studying to find a better way. And if you short circuit that process, what it usually just means is more labor for you. You know, if I use a chemical to, and only use a chemical to try to mitigate a nutrient, I'm going to always have to keep using that chemical. It's like a drug to my soil. But if I use nature and I bring the natural effects, if I'm bringing manures and I'm bringing beneficial bacteria, you know, I'm bringing worm castings and worm teas and bringing the stuff that has the life in it, what nature does, then it requires less and less of that over time, but the soil gets better and better. So it's a synergistic, a positive loop synergistic cycle. So every year that soil just keeps getting better and better and better, whereas a straight chemical trying to address the need based on the chemical need, it becomes worse and worse over time because the nature and the life starts depleting. Now, a good example of that, when you go to the store to get some of your biomass, a lot of people buy bags of manure or bags of soil additives. I recommend doing one little test. I call it the dent test. And what you do is that before you buy that bag of soil, number one, if it's under shade, is much better off. And the reason that is because, and you'll find this to be true, if you go to where they're in the sun all the time and you do the dent test, which is you kick the bag. So if you kick the bag and it doesn't hold the dent, that soil mass is dead. So no matter what nutrients you thought you were getting out of that, whatever is there, it's dead and it's going to have to be brought back to life before your plants will even be able to uptake the nutrients in it. And so it's dead. And so if it doesn't hold a dent, I wouldn't buy the bag. What happens is it's been superheated. The bag's been superheated. It's been excessively dried. And therefore, no life exists remaining inside of that bag. So if I want a good soil, I mean, you'll find the best, most expensive bagged soils are in the shade at the top nurseries. They are in the shade. And they're even close to the door. You know, and it might be worth it to get that if you want it all in one package ready to go. And you can still do a dent test on those too, you know, and kick it or put a thumb fingerprints in it, you know, put some knuckles into it and see if it holds the dent. Because that means it's still alive. That's what good soil does. It sticks together. You know, when it gets hit, it compacts a little bit, but it holds that form. And it's much slower to react. And that's what you want. We want soil that's full of nutrients, alive, and slow to react to excessive temperatures, water changes, all of those things. So dent test. Remember that next time you're at the store.
And just because it's outside doesn't mean it won't pass the dent test. I mean, the pallet could have been dropped off this morning.
Exactly.
And there could be a nursery guy listening that's like taking all of his stuff from outside and he's putting it inside now by the checkout side, marking it up and taking all the stuff that's been under shed and bringing it outside. So,
I inadvertently just taught some people how to trick the public. No, dent test will always work whether it's outside or inside. Do that little dent test to just double check, especially if what you're trying to get is biomass. Now, if you did a dent test on some gypsum, it ain't going to hold that dent unless it's wet. Because it's not alive. It's just it's a mineral. It's a mineral that we're using. But when we're trying to add that biomass, again, you want 1/3 is going to be a lot of that biomass. Good, healthy stuff, living matter that's mixed in with your soil. And then we love to top it off. And that's another key piece is that once you've got that in there, that you're not totally done. You've now just amended it. And you've got some good nutrient in it. You've got a lot of, you know, different variety of biomass. I don't like just doing one thing. And now I want to start mulching the top of it a little bit. And general rule, a lot of people out there get the tree mulch. You know, they'll go to chipdrop.com, which is a great place to get a free source of mulch. And that's going to be fresh chipped tree drop. And the trick with that, though, is that as that breaks down, it actually sucks nitrogen out of your soil. So you got to be careful on how you use that. You're using that hopefully in an area that you're not planting in yet. I would give 3 to 6 months before you're going to be planting anything smaller than a 5-gallon tree if you're going to be doing stuff like that, because it's sucking nitrogen out of that surface level of soil. And so if your roots are trying to grow in that same space, it's going to be sucking the nitrogen out. It's going to make it really tough on that plant. And it also attracts a lot of interesting other creatures and other things as it's breaking down. It doesn't smell the greatest either if you have too big of a pile of that. So it is important to have that type of layer. General rule of thumb is that the type of chip mulch I need and how deep I need it, it's 4 times the average length of that chip. So if I've got really rough wood chip that's 4 inches long, you know, I need 16 inches deep of that in order for it to really be effective as a mulch to reduce the heat, keep the soil, you know, keep the soil moist, all the effects that we want mulch to do. But as you can tell, if I've got mulch that high and I'm trying to grow a plant, well, I need that plant planted in the original soil, and now I'm covering it with all that mulch, that's not effective. So I need, if I've got smaller plants, I need smaller chip size mulch or compost is better for your typical gardens. We're using compost on the top, like an inch a layer of compost, and that's great because my particle or my material size is much smaller and it's finer. And that's going to allow for the plant to grow. It'll hold the moisture quite well. That's why a lot of people like using peat moss-based stuff, because the particle size is very small, networked together, and actually works great.
So I was going to ask about peat moss, because ever since you talked about your soil acting like a sponge at the beginning, I was, you know, if you've ever had to or played with any of the peat moss you get at a garden store, you know, it's like a natural sponge. You add water to it, and it's
great.
You know, is that an additive on top of the gypsum that you put into your soil, or when and how do you apply peat moss?
You definitely can, and that's one of those things that source-wise, it's a little harder to come by ecologically. You know, it's harvested from the northern states and stuff and Canada, and these are ancient patches of all this peat moss. And so for a more sustainable approach for us, it's like I definitely like peat moss if I don't have anything else available that might work. But I like using even coconut coir, or we'll use just...
Oh, yeah, since we have so many coconuts here in Arizona.
Yeah, well, that's another reason, right? So shredded, but oddly enough, we process a lot of coconut stuff here. So there is some excess coconut coir that's kind of in the southern states, which is weird, but that's it's
cool.
It's actually more accessible than peat moss, than peat moss. So that's the other thing.
And I don't know anything about the coconuts or processing, but I would imagine we do it because it's a drier climate, so it probably preserves it longer instead of, you know, a moisture climate where you know, mold would or other, you know, stuff would just start growing. That makes sense.
Yeah,
that it would be a big manufacturing a destination for that product.
So other things like shredded paper or shredded cardboard, that actually works pretty good. Oddly enough, something we've been playing around with is it's sheep wool. So sheep wool actually is a better and more renewable source for that same type of peat moss effect that you can get from sheep wool. And obviously I've got some sheep, and so we play around with stuff. Especially if you got a dark colored sheep, you know, you get the black sheep in the family, that's actually a good thing for your garden, you know, because it's darker in color and so you don't notice as much, but it acts in a similar fashion as does a peat moss in your garden as a moisture controller, and actually it deters a lot of other pests and things too. So it's kind of a fun thing. If it's kind of a new age thing. So if you want the new age approach, you know, go find some little bit of sheep stuff.
All right, so I got to ask a little bit more. I've never heard anybody talking about using sheep's wool as a composting material or a garden amendment or a soil amendment. Did you get the sheep for this, or you had the sheep for another purpose and this just kind of naturally discovered it?
I think it came around because I had the sheep, and anybody who has sheep, especially that have to be sheared, I mean, this is around the time I start shearing my sheep, is that we're going to have the good wool that we can weave into fabric and, you know, pillow stuffing and stuff like that. That's the majority of the sheep wool. But then we got the tail end sheep wool that comes out a little bit more fluffy and has dingleberries, if you know what I'm talking about. So we got a little bit more nutrient around that part of the sheep. And it doesn't come off in bigger pieces that you can really do anything with. It's not worth washing. It's not worth cleaning. And so here's this stuff I've got. And what do I do with that? And so we start realizing, well, there's a lot of nutrient in it, and it's got some good, it holds moisture seemingly a lot better than some of the other parts of the sheep wool. And so it's like, what do we do with those entrail sheep wool? And that's the part that becomes really valuable and can be integrated right into your garden. And you weave it in a similar manner. You don't want any more than one third of your soil to have a bunch of sheep wool in it. And we want it broken down into small pieces. And so that's what we have essentially with those end parts, you know, the wool coming off the feet, you know, around the face, other little parts. It's like they're just little pieces. It's like cotton ball looking things that are floating around. And that's the kind of stuff that we then use. And we can actually soak it in some compost tea, and then we stick it in the garden. And now you're like long range. It's like now you got long term, bioactive nutrient that we're now applying to the soil that's even more valuable. So it's kind of a new age thing. Those who own sheep have kind of always done it, but now people are starting to hear about, you know, hey, this might be a viable alternative to and renewable option to specifically the sphagnum peat moss. And so that's kind of fun.
Never heard that before. Very cool and very interesting. And wrapping up here, we've talked a lot of different things and components and gypsum and pH and peat moss and sheep. What's the final thing to wrap up our soil prep before the hour's over?
Yeah, so as we break it down, we've dug the soil, we've broken it up. You know, we've gotten down at least 18 inches for our vegetable garden. We've broken that up. We've gotten some gypsum to make sure it's draining well. Now we've got in some biomass. We've got some good compost, some living matter that we've mixed into the soil. And so it's dark, it's full, it's fluffy, it's awesome. The last thing that we often will do, we also talked about putting a little bit of compost at the top, and then maybe a little bit of mulch on top of that. So we've created kind of this lasagna layer for the top few inches. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to add some compost tea. Now compost tea is a living product. You can use worm tea. That's a good compost tea. And we're mixing that with water, about 2 ounces per gallon of some good nutrient-rich compost tea or some worm tea. And then we're spraying it over that area and letting it perk down through. So we're going to kind of saturate the space. And what we're doing is we're bringing a lot of new bioactive. We're bringing a lot of the micronutrients as well as the bioactive stuff. So we've got the beneficial bacteria and things. And we're letting that perk into the soil to now bring it all to life, which will help starting it to stick together and start making the nutrient now accessible to whatever we plant in it. And that leads into kind of the final piece, which is ironically, the most important. I know we said soil is the most important thing, and this is the next most important thing, and it's by hierarchy of need. In order for my soil to stay healthy and alive, I need it to have water. I need it to be moist. I need it to have regular occurring water events that keep it moist and keep the bacteria alive and keep everything flowing well. And so making sure that you've got a good timeline for it, continually adding moisture to your soil is an important piece. And if you're new to getting soil in, finger test is probably the easiest way. If it's moist down an inch down, then I'm okay. If it's dry, I want to water it. Make sure I deep soak it and get the water to percolate down to that at least that 18 inches every time I water so that I'm building the entire soil mass for nutrient uptake for my plants.
Now, this is going to be a hard question to answer in 30 seconds, but that's about what we have left because I want to make sure we hit the botanical gardens. Soil, water, but light. I mean, a lot of these vegetable plants, you know, you've got to be careful not putting them in an area where they're going to get too much shade because they've got to have that light for photosynthesis.
Right. And it's really about understanding microclimates and the right plant for that microclimate. So if you haven't had your property mapped out for microclimates and what are the plants conducive to those spaces, I highly recommend it. You can go to agriscaping.com, say, you know, get started. Go to the get started and you can learn more and you can get your property mapped out. And have that understanding because every area of your yard can grow a plant. It's just which plant and when do I plant that thing? And you can grow food, even 300 varieties, even in the full shade. You just got to know the right varieties to do that.
Agriscaping.com, get started. That'll get you your microclimate map. Botanical gardens. You were talking about a big rodeo festival music event coming up.
Well, yeah, coming up. Roots and Boots is next week. The Queen Creek Botanical Gardens are open, especially on Saturdays. If you want to see everything we talked about and learn more and get questions answered, go there. Queen Creek Botanical Gardens down off of Riggs Road and Ellsworth.
Riggs Road and Ellsworth. And next, the Boots.
Roots and Boots is next week. Weekend. Oh, it's a great event. So, Activities is what we're all about. It's a fun place to be. Come and join us.